Blog Talk Radio.
After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to be. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
You're listening to the Revolutionary Radio Project. With your host, Rob Skiba.
All I'm offering is the truth.
Shabbat shalom, everybody. Welcome to Virtual House Church 8 on the Revolutionary Radio Project. I am your host, Rob Skiba. We are still 1 week behind. I'm going to do my best to try to get us caught up as quickly as possible, especially before next week, because after all, you know, next Friday is the end of the world, right? At least so some people say. I, of course, do not believe that. Do not believe that December 21st, 2012 is the end of the world. Although I do believe there could be some significant things that may happen on that day. But I guess we shall just wait and see. But I'm actually really excited about the Torah portion reading that we're going to have that was put into place thousands of years ago for us to just so happen to read on that very day. But in the meantime, we are still playing catch up. The one we're doing right now, Virtual House Church 8, is week 8 in the Torah cycle. We'll be covering Genesis 32 through 36, verse 43. And in the prophets section, we'll be doing Hosea 11 through 12, 12. And in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 5, 1 through 13, Hebrews 11, 1 through 40, and Revelation 7, 1 through 12. And the way it works is I will play some audio from these portions, and I'm using the audio from Bible.is. You can go to Bible.is and check that out. Some pretty cool tools they have there, various translations you can listen to, and different formats of audio, from just plain readings to reading with music behind it, and in some cases even dramatic reading, which is the one that I've chosen to use for these shows. It keeps it interesting, using the English Standard Version, the dramatized audio from Bible.is. So what I do is I play that, and you guys listen, and then I would like you to call in so that we can chat and do this together. The guest call-in is 619-789-6815. That's 619-789-6815. And basically we'll just talk and chat and share insights. You'll have insights that I don't have. I might have insights that you don't have. And together we can share what these scriptures mean to us. And so I welcome you to join the conversation. It's always a lot better when there's a lot more interaction, and you don't have to just listen to me. So let's go ahead and get started. We'll start with Genesis chapter 32.
Genesis 32. Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said,
"This is God's camp."
So he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom, instructing them,
"Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male servants, and female servants. I have sent to tell my lord in order that I may find favor in your sight.
And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying,
We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him.
Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. He divided the people who were with him, and the flocks and herds and camels, into two camps, thinking,
If Esau comes to the one camp and attacks it, then the camp that is left will escape.
And Jacob said,
O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, Return to your country and to your kindred, that I may do you good. I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. But you said, I will surely do you good, and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude.
So he stayed there that night, and from what he had with him he took a present for his brother Esau, 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their calves, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys, and 10 male donkeys. These he handed over to his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants,
Pass on ahead of me, and put a space between drove and drove.
He instructed the first,
When Esau my brother meets you and asks you, To whom do you belong? Where are you going? And whose are these ahead of you? Then you shall say, They belong to your servant Jacob. They are a present sent to my lord Esau. And moreover, he is behind us.
He likewise instructed the second and the third and all who followed the droves.
You shall say the same thing to Esau when you find him, and you shall say, Moreover, your servant Jacob is behind us.
For he thought,
I may appease him with the present that goes ahead of me, and afterward I shall see his face. Perhaps he will accept me.
So the present passed on ahead of him, and he himself stayed that night in the camp. The same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had, and Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said,
Let me go, for the day has broken.
But Jacob said,
I will not let you go unless you bless me.
And he said to him,
What is your name?
And he said,
Jacob.
Then he said,
Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men, and have prevailed.
Then Jacob asked him,
Please, tell me your name.
But he said,
Why is it that you ask my name?
And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Penuel, saying,
For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered.
The sun rose upon him as he passed Penuel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the people of Israel do not eat the sinew of the thigh that is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip on the sinew of the thigh.
And that's it for Genesis chapter 32. I'm going to do like I did last week, at least until I get some more interaction here in the studio. If you would like to interact with me and share your insights on these scriptures, please give me a call, 619-789-6815. In the meantime, I'm going to read something from a website that my wife found called yourlivingwaters.com. YourLivingWaters.com. There's an individual by the name of Ardell that has written some very good commentary on the Torah portions. he says regarding this chapter. He says, in Jacob's life, we encounter both tragedies and triumphs. Both are necessary for him to be able to take 12 sons with distinct personalities and separate goals and mold them into the fledgling nation of Israel. There never seems to be a let-up in the challenges and dangers that face them. All of their experiences will teach them the importance of constantly clinging to the promises that he will never leave them nor forsake them, he, of course, being Yehovah. Genesis 28:15 says, behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, and I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. Deuteronomy 31:8, and Yehovah, he is the one who goes before you. He will be with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. Do not fear nor be dismayed. Matthew 28:20, teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Amen. The events, now that's an interesting one, even to the end of the age, if we are to think about what I mentioned earlier with regard to, and it's not just the Mayans. The Mayans, the Aztec calendar stone, that calendar originated in 3114 BC, so the scholars tell us. And it's not the end of the world, but it seems to depict the end of an age. I find that rather interesting, if there's any truth to that whatsoever. Again, it's not the end of the world, but could be the end of an age and the beginning of a new one. Very interesting, the way that's worded in Matthew 28. The events of the life of Jacob stare us in the face as if we are looking in a mirror. Why? Because they chart our own course in life as well. We also must have faith and the will to persevere while we are being restored to a proper relationship with the Father. Jeremiah equates this future time of Jacob's trouble with the restoration of his people Israel. In Jeremiah 30, verse 1, it says, the word came to Jeremiah from Yehovah, saying, thus speaks Yehovah Elohim of Israel, saying, write in a book for yourself all the words that I have spoken to you. For behold, the days are coming, says Yehovah, that I will bring back from captivity my people Israel and Judah, says Yehovah. And I will cause them to return to the land that I gave to their fathers, and they shall possess it. Now these are the words that Yehovah spoke concerning Israel and Judah. For thus says Yehovah, we have heard a voice of trembling, of fear, and not of peace. Ask now and see whether a man is ever in labor with child. So why do I see every man with his hands on his loins like a woman in labor, and all faces turn pale? Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it, and it is the time of Jacob's trouble. But he shall be saved out of it. Something interesting about Jacob's trouble, and this is something I've never really thought about before. I guess I've always thought, maybe I thought wrongly, I don't know, but it seems to me that I was always taught that the time of Jacob's trouble is the tribulation period, usually associated with a seven-year time period. But as we were looking through the Torah, you quickly realize that Jacob's trouble actually lasted 20 years. From the time that he deceived his father, you remember his father had poor eyesight and he put on a garment to make him his skin feel like that of Esau, and he cheated his brother out of the blessing. That's when his trouble began. That's when he took off running, and his trouble lasted 20 years. Remember, he fell in love with Rachel, and he worked for her for 7 years, but got Leah. And so there's 7 years right there. And then after he got Leah and said, "Hey, look, I wanted Rachel," and Laban says, "Well, you got to work another 7 years." So there's seven more years. That's 14, and then there were 6 years of wealth building after that before he finally left Laban's house. And so, to be reconciled with his brother, which we'll get to in a few minutes. So actually, the time of Jacob's trouble was really 20 years. So I started to think about that with regard to the 119 Ministries end times calendar. They have an end of days series, about five or six videos long. And in one of them, they go through Daniel's timeline, and they take a look at the tetrad cycles that are coming up in 2014 and 15, and the fact that these blood moons and solar eclipses land on feast days, during those years, and they make a case for that preceding the Day of the Lord, which we know would fall on the Feast of Trumpets. So they say the Feast of Trumpets being September 1st, 2016, would be a possible candidate for the Day of the Lord. And they say if that's true, then you back off 1,260 days from that to find the abomination of desolation. Of course, they're working on a 3.5-year tribulation period, or great tribulation, which would mean we're now in the tribulation period, the first 3.5 years, if their model is correct. 1,260 days backwards from September 1st, 2016 puts you in 3-2-2-13, March 22nd of next year. What's interesting about that model, is if it's true, and I'm going to just say in advance, I don't believe it's true, but if it were, it's interesting the case they make regarding the abomination of desolation, where Jesus says, for when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let those in Judea flee to the mountains, flee to the wilderness, right? And then he says, pray that your flight be not in winter and not on the Sabbath. Well, get your calendar out, look it up. 3-2-2 of next year is the day after winter and the day before a Sabbath, day before Saturday. So that's awfully interesting and rather peculiar. But 119 makes the statement, and they kind of follow suit with what Mark Biltz has said, that this tetrad cycle doesn't happen again for over 100 years. But our Torah study leader, Kevin Roberts, who's been on here before, he has calculated, based on what we know from scriptures and God's calendar, as well as looking at the NASA website, and basing it on the dark moon as opposed to the sliver moon, being the first of the month, that there is a very interesting tetrad cycle coming up in 32 and 33, 33, 34, something like that, in that time frame. And his model, which I still don't completely understand, although I've heard it a few times and need to understand it because I'm actually going to teach a little bit about it at the Future Congress coming up next month, he says that the tetrad cycle that's coming up at that time is even more significant than the one that's coming up in the 2014-2015 time frame. What I find interesting about that is 2033, of course, is 20 years away from 2013. So could it be that the time, the 20-year time of Jacob's trouble may begin at 3-2-2-13? I don't know. But we were thinking about all these things last week and last week's study and trying to figure out what the significance of, in terms of the last days and the story of Jacob and everything, how does that pertain to us? It could be that it pertains to us in the sense of a 20-year time period called Jacob's Trouble that may be coming into being maybe next year. I don't know. Just thoughts. If you've got thoughts on that, give me a call. 619-789-6815. Let me pick up in where this guy left off, Ardell, in his Torah study thing here. It says, the first verse of our Torah reading, and that being Genesis 32, verse 3, gives us clues that we are returning to the subject of the selling of the birthright. In Genesis 32, 3, then Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the field of Edom. Seir means shaggy or hairy and refers back to Esau's appearance upon birth. That's according to Genesis 25:25. Field. Esau was described as a man of the field in Genesis 25:27. And Isaac sent Esau out to the field to get venison. That's in Genesis 27:3. Edom means red and brings to mind the red, red stew that Jacob used to purchase the birthright in Genesis 25, verses 30 and 32. Jacob is fearful of a confrontation with his brother and confesses that fear to the Almighty in a plea for deliverance in Genesis 32, 9. Then Jacob said, O Elohim of my father Abraham and Elohim of my father Isaac, Jehovah, who said to me, return to your country and to your family, and I will deal well with you. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which you have shown your servant. For I crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me and the mother with the children. Over 20 years ago, Jacob deceived his brother. As a result, Esau had expressed his intent to kill him. Jacob had fled the scene of disloyalty and gone to the country of his mother. There he met his match in deceit in the person of Laban. Many of the lessons that Jacob learned in Haran came as a result of being the victim of Laban's deceit. After physically and emotionally separating from Laban, Jacob is now forced to face his fear of Esau. Jacob hears that Esau is coming to meet him with a force of 400 men. He is understandably afraid and, according to the sages, proceeds with three tactics. 1. Diplomacy. He prepares lavish gifts of herds and flocks in Genesis 32, verses 13 through 15. 2. Prayer, Genesis 32, 11. 3. Readiness for war. He divides his household into two camps, so at least one would survive in Genesis 32, 7 through 8, or 7 and 8. Before the meeting occurs, however, Jacob finds himself in a wrestling match. Of course, the age-old question is, who is Jacob wrestling with? Our first clue from the Torah is that he wrestles with an ish, that's the Hebrew for a man. Genesis 32:24. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. A few verses later, it implies that the man is divine, Genesis 32:30. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen Elohim face to face, and my life is preserved. This is not the first time that Jacob has found himself wrestling. His mother was first aware of the brothers wrestling in her womb in Genesis 25:21. Rebekah, his wife, conceived, but the children struggled within her. Jacob also wrestled for years with his father-in-law, Laban. After 20 years, he was able to part from him as an overcomer with both his family and his possessions intact. Keep that in mind, overcomer. Our study tells us that Jacob is alone in Genesis 32:24. Yet in the dark, he is wrestling with a man. Could Jacob be wrestling with himself? Jacob wronged his brother and felt guilt, which gave birth to fear. Thus, we could say that Jacob's fleshly nature, his ish, is wrestling with the spirit within him. Now, sin's desire is always to have mastery over our flesh, as pictured by Elohim's warning to Cain in Genesis 4:7. If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. As we know, Cain did not master his sin. He ended up killing his brother Abel and being exiled from his family. Now it is Jacob's turn to finally master his sin from over 20 years ago. We see him do this by confession through his name in Genesis 32:27. So he said to him, "What is your name?" He said, "Jacob." One of the meanings of Jacob's name is he will deceive. By speaking his name, he is accepting the truth about who he really is. He answers, "I am a deceiver. I deceived my brother and took his birthright by selling him a bowl of lentil soup. I deceived our father and stole my brother's blessing." This confession is a turning point of victory for Jacob. Now, that's certainly one point of view, and we've all heard that being taught that Jacob's name means deceiver. Although, if you look in when his name is given to him, it's not because of deception. The meaning of his name that I understand, and in fact is given in a Dictionary of Scripture Proper Names by J.B. Jackson, is that he shall grab hold of the heel. And we see that that's what he was doing. You know, when he was wrestling in the womb with his brother, you see that his hand was grabbing hold of the heel. So we might think of his name as "will take hold of," but specifically "will take hold of the heel." Although there's a lot of people that say his name means he will deceive, and that's apparently what this commentator believes also. So anyway, let's go ahead and see what else he has to say. He says, "The rest of Jacob's confession is a name change from deceiver to the strait of El. Yasher means straight or upright, plus El, put together, is Israel. The verse tells us that Jacob has prevailed, and his spiritual and fleshly struggle are in his spiritual and fleshly struggle against deception. Genesis 32:28. And he said, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with Elohim and with men, and have prevailed. The wrestling match has prepared Jacob for his actual encounter with Esau. One of the things that jumped out at me as I began to understand that when we accept Yeshua as our Savior, that we are grafted in. We are the wild olive tree grafted into the cultivated olive tree, which is Israel. We come in if we are not blood-related, otherwise through the banner of Ephraim, and become Israel. I know a lot of people struggle with that idea, but that's what the scriptures tell us. We're grafted in, and that's the family we're grafted into. And when New Jerusalem comes down from heaven, it has 12 names on it, and one of them is not the church. It's 12 names, and they're the 12 tribes of Israel. And it says that is the bride of the Lamb coming down. So if we understand ourselves as Christians to be the bride of Christ, then we are Israel, according to numerous passages in the scripture. What's interesting to me about that is he gets that name after he overcomes, after he wrestles with God and prevails. And there's a couple things that's interesting about that story. He calls the name of the place Peniel. He says, for I've seen God face to face. What's interesting to me about that is Peniel is also the name, and it's spelled differently, but it's the gland in your brain, the pineal gland, is what many people refer to as the third eye. Those in the New Age and the occult are real big about talking about the third eye as a way of opening up your spiritual awareness. And I maintain that anytime you see these things in the occult, that's a counterfeit. If it's a counterfeit, you only counterfeit real things. You don't counterfeit $3 bills because there's no such thing as a $3 bill, but you do counterfeit things of value like a $100 bill. So if we're looking at things in the occult, like awakening the third eye, for instance, that is a counterfeit. So what is the real? I just find it interesting that Jacob names that place Peniel, and it's because he had an encounter face-to-face with God. That's the first thing that stands out at me. The other thing that stands, and actually Dr. Mike Bennett, Dr. Future, he has a really interesting talk on DMT and how that works to open up the spirit realm, specifically in the pineal gland. If you get a chance to, you should Google that or go on YouTube or see what he has to say out there. Actually, I saw Matthew Miller had posted a YouTube video that was actually an audio from his radio show where he interviewed Mike Bennett on this, and he spent a lot of time talking about the DMT and pharmakia and how that can be used to increase DMT and awaken the third eye and all that stuff. A very interesting teaching, so you might want to check that out. But the other thing that jumped out at me is the fact that his name is changed to Israel, and it's associated with being an overcomer. And when you go to the book of Revelation, you see an awful lot about what God has to say, or what Yeshua has to say, about he who overcomes. I think it's mentioned seven times, actually, but you see it over and over and over again, blessed is he that overcomes. And so I started thinking, well, wait a minute, is it saying blessed are those who realize that they are Israel? I made a note to myself as I was going through Revelation chapter 2 and 3 that I believe it is tied to Genesis 32. Just food for thought. If you have any thoughts, please give me a call at 619-789-6815. And I've just noticed there's really not a whole lot of people listening tonight. It could be everybody's glued to their TVs regarding the terrible tragedy in Connecticut earlier today. And let me just say, you know, we grieve here for those families and we lift them up in prayer. It is a tragedy, no doubt, but I also believe it is an agenda. And you know it's an agenda because of the propaganda that's being pushed like every 5 minutes. While you're watching this on the news, every 5 minutes they're talking about stricter gun control laws. So anyway, I'm not going to go there. I could very easily get pretty political right now, and I'm not going to do it. So let's just go ahead and continue. I will go to Genesis chapter 33. And again, I just want to say, please say a prayer for these families in Connecticut that have lost their children. In fact, I'll just do that right now. Jehovah, Father God, this is a Shabbat. This is a day of rest right now since the sun went down, but I know a lot of people are struggling and going through an awful lot of pain right now. Is anything but a day of rest. So I just pray that your peace that passes all understanding will descend on these families, Father, that your shalom will be upon them, that you will heal them, Lord. It's hard to even know how to pray because it is such a tragic, terrible event. But God, you are still in control, and you are able to do exceedingly and abundantly above all that we could ask, hope, or even imagine. And so, Lord, I just pray for your hand to be upon these families, that you will touch them, that you will cover them in your love in this time of tragic loss. And just lift them up to you right now in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right. Let's go on to Genesis 33.
Genesis 33. And Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two female servants. And he put the servants with their children in front, then Leah with her children, and Rachel and Joseph last of all. He himself went on before them, bowing himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And when Esau lifted up his eyes and saw the women and children, he said,
"Who are these with you?"
Jacob said,
"The children whom God has graciously given your servant."
Then the servants drew near, they and their children, and bowed down. Leah likewise and her children drew near and bowed down. And last, Joseph and Rachel drew near, and they bowed down. Esau said,
"What do you mean by all this company that I met?"
Jacob answered,
"To find favor in the sight of my Lord."
But Esau said,
"I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself."
Jacob said,
"No, please. If I have found favor in your sight, then accept my present from my hand. For I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me. Please accept my blessing that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough."
Thus he urged him, and he took it. And then Esau said,
"Let us journey on our way, and I will go ahead of you."
But Jacob said to him,
"My lord knows that the children are frail, and that the nursing flocks and herds are a care to me. If they are driven hard for one day, all the flocks will die. Let my lord pass on ahead of his servant, and I will lead on slowly, at the pace of the livestock that are ahead of me, and at the pace of the children, until I come to my lord in Seir."
So Esau said,
"Let me leave with you some of the people who are with me."
But he said,
"What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my lord."
So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. But Jacob journeyed to Succoth, and built himself a house, and made booths for his livestock. Therefore the name of the place is called Succoth. And Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, on his way from Paddan Aram, and he camped before the city. And from the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, he bought for 100 pieces of money the piece of land on which he had pitched his tent. There he erected an altar and called it El Elohe Israel.
That is really interesting. If you go to virtualhousechurch.com, you can go to and look at the link. It says extras, and I try to put extras in for every one of these studies as I find things just to add to the study. But if you go there, go to virtualhousechurch.com, click on the extras. Of course, if you go right to the homepage, it's going to bump you down to the extras for Genesis week 8, which is the one we're doing right now. So you actually have to scroll up to the top. But if you scroll up to the top, you'll see an image that I put up there from week 1 from a study from week one regarding Eden. And in the first study there, I talked about my belief concerning the region, the geographical location of Eden, and what I think the significance is of Israel, and how I believe that Israel is, that geographical location represents the physical location of where the garden was placed in Eden. And I mentioned that I believe that the two trees, the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, are actually located in Shechem. And I base that on a whole bunch of scriptures where everybody keeps being brought back to that one specific location. In fact, when Abram at that time was called out of Ur of the Chaldees, interesting thing about Ur is its patron god was a god named Sin. So Abraham was called out of Sin, Ur of the Chaldees, to go to a place that God would show him. He came up over the top of the Levant, came down through the Fertile Crescent there, through Lebanon, and when he got into the land we now call Israel, the land of Canaan at the time, God stopped him at Shechem. Okay, stop. Take a look around. It's all yours. And you see, there's a lot of stories in the Bible that keep focusing you back on the specific location. So I think it's really interesting that first God changes Jacob's name to Israel, and then it's Israel who purchases the land of Shechem. That he bought back that which was lost in the Garden of Eden. And it's just this, just my theory, just speculation based on the research that I've been doing on this, but I do find it very, very interesting that it was Israel who bought the land of Shechem. So let's see what else is we can pull out of this study from the from Ardell's writing. And this is, again, I'm taking this study from yourlivingwaters.com. You could go there and check out the downloads that this individual named Ardell has written on these Torah portions. He says, in the study called Toldot, we read how decisions Esau made distanced him from the family when he purposely took wives from the forbidden Canaanites. Genesis 26:34. When Esau was 40 years old, he took as wives Judith, the daughter of Beeri, the Hittite. And we learned the Hittite means terrors. They were Nephilim. And Basemath, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite. And they were a grief of mind to Isaac and Rebekah. Judith, also called Oholibama, mother was Anah. And Anah was the daughter of Zibion, a Hivite. The Hivites, their name means showers of life. Genesis 36:2. Thus Judith was a Hittite on her father's side and a Hivite on her mother's side, both Canaanites. Okay, and we've learned in our previous study that Canaanites were Nephilim. By marrying her, Esau made smart political family connections with both the Hittites and the Hivites, two prominent Canaanite nations. These decisions are consistent with the materialistic tendencies he displayed early on in life. He placed a low value on the spiritual blessings, which were a part of the covenant made with his grandfather Abraham. Esau was more concerned with worldly gain in the present, not with promises to be fulfilled in the distant future. Basemath, or Ada, was also the daughter of a Hittite. She appears to be Esau's favored wife, as she is listed first in Genesis 36:10, and her son Eliphaz is called Esau's firstborn. Genesis 36:15. These were the chiefs of the sons of Esau, the sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn son of Esau. Rebekah made it clear how she felt about these Hittite, the children of Heth, which again means the terror, the Hittite wives, in Genesis 27:46. And Rebekah said to Isaac, I am weary of my life because of the daughters of Heth. If Jacob takes a wife of the daughters of Heth, like these who are the daughters of the land, what good will my life be to me? After Jacob fled to Haran, Esau took a third wife, apparently in an effort to please his parents by marrying a Hebrew. In Genesis 28:6, Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Padan Aram, to take himself a wife from there, and that he blessed him. He gave him a charge, saying, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. and that Jacob had obeyed his father and his mother and had gone to Padan Aram. Also, Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan did not please his father Isaac. So Esau went to Ishmael and took Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebajoth, to be his wife, in addition to the wives that he had. The fact is that Mahalath was quite a mixture. It is true that she had no Canaanite blood in her, which means she was not a Nephilim, but with Hagar as her grandmother, she turns out to be three-quarters Egyptian. So when we put this all together, we see that Esau has intermingled with Hebrews, Hittites, Hivites, Ishmaelites, and Egyptians. It's no wonder that his offspring are called Arabs, which means mixture. Very interesting. When the brothers meet, all of Jacob's fears appear to be unfounded. There's nothing in Esau's behavior that speaks of anger, revenge, or hatred. Note Genesis 33:4. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Whether Esau is being genuine or not is not the focus of this study. Far more interesting is Jacob's behavior and his words during their encounter. Genesis 33:3, and Jacob bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. Jacob bows 7 times, fully prostrating himself to the ground, and this is followed by his wives and their children also bowing before Esau. Next, we are told that 4 times Jacob will call Esau my Adonai, in Genesis 33:8, 13, 14, and 15. Twice he will call himself Esau's servant, Genesis 33:5 and 14. What's up with this apparent reversal of Jacob's blessing? Remember Genesis 27:29, that he shall be master over your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you? And we can connect these details with the wrestling match of the night before. Can we do that? Can we connect this with the wrestling match of the night before? A logical conclusion before the wrestling match would be that, or a logical conclusion after the wrestling match would be that Jacob was now in a position to overcome whatever situation he may be in with his brother Esau. Why then do we not see him asserting the authority he was given over his brother? Are we disappointed that we are not seeing a new and confident Jacob? Then, to top it all off, catch this exchange of words when Jacob is presenting Esau with the gifts he has prepared for him. Genesis 33:8. Then Esau said, what do you mean by all this company which I met? And he said, these are to find favor in the sight of my Adonai. But Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. And Jacob said, no, please, if I have now found favor in your sight, then receive my present from my hand, inasmuch as I have seen your face as though I had seen the face of Elohim, and you were pleased with me. Please take my blessing that is brought to you, because Elohim has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. So he urged him, and he took it. Whoa, there's a subtle change here, and I don't want you to miss it. Jacob suddenly goes from asking Esau to accept his present, mentioned 5 times in the story as Mincha, to asking him to take his blessing, Bracha. There are other strange things being said here. Why would seeing Esau be as though he had seen the face of Elohim? Whether you've noticed it or not, the word face and its many Hebrew variants have made many appearances in our study. Here are a few. Genesis 32:30. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, face of El, for I have seen Elohim face to face, Panim. Panim, Panim. So that's face to face. And my life is preserved. Genesis 32:20, and also say, behold, your servant Jacob is behind us, for he said, I will appease, in other words, cover the anger from his face, him with the present that goes before me, before his face. And afterward, I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me, or in other words, lift up my face. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks writes that the clue to his face's drama is in the word blessing, Genesis 33:11. From our study a couple of weeks ago in Toldot, let's remind ourselves of what the blessing was that Jacob stole when he became an impostor of his brother, in Genesis 27:28. It says, "Therefore, may Elohim give you of the dew of heaven, of the fatness of the earth, and plenty of grain and wine," verse 29. "Let people serve you, and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brothers, and let your mother's sons bow down to you." Rabbi Sacks teaches that his blessing is about wealth and power. Also, do you remember from Toldot when we differentiated between the covenantal blessing of the birthright and a father's blessing, which was a prophecy of personal destiny? Jacob's stolen blessing was a bracha. The birthright blessing, the bechira, was given to Jacob before he left for Haran, in Genesis 28:3. May El Shaddai bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may be an assembly of peoples, and give you the blessing of Abraham, to you and your descendants with you, that you may inherit the land in which you are a stranger, which Elohim gave to Abraham. This second blessing given to Jacob is the covenantal blessing which was first given to Abraham. It focuses on descendants and the land. It has nothing to do with wealth or power. Jehovah never promised Abraham the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth. Now, Rabbi Sacks also points out another significant fact. We know that at the time of the blessings, Isaac was blind. This is the only reason why Jacob was able to pull off the impersonation. Because he could not see, Isaac was forced to trust his other senses. He tasted the food, he touched Jacob's hands, and he smelled his clothes. He also heard his voice, which he said sounds like the voice of Jacob, and then replied that the hands were the hands of Esau. Therefore, after some doubt, Isaac trusted his other senses over what he heard, Shema, and gives Jacob the blessing, the bracha. Now remember, all of this has happened because he cannot see Jacob's face. The sages teach that each of the patriarchs were role models for us to learn how to handle challenges. From Abraham, we learn the strength of conviction and how to stand apart in an ungodly culture. Isaac was the picture of sacrifice, and as believers, we also must identify with the sacrifice of our Messiah, Yeshua. And now Jacob becomes our role model of learning our identity. Micah speaks of what will be given to Jacob in Micah 7:20. "You will give truth to Jacob." Truth is what Jacob wrestled for. It was a truth about identity. Jacob needed to come face to face with that reality. He needed to look in a mirror. James says the mirror is the Torah, the perfect law of liberty. Yeshua is the Word made flesh, and thus by reading Jehovah's Torah, or his instructions, we can see his face, and we can see ourselves in the mirror as well. James 1:22 says, "But be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves." 23. "For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. For he observes himself, goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But he who looks into the perfect Torah of liberty and continues in it, and is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this one will be blessed in what he does." In his wrestling, Jacob came face to face, like looking in a mirror, with his Torah of liberty, whom we know as Yeshua, the Messiah. He came away from it with a new identity reflected in his new name. He also received the blessing of destiny. Now, I hope that you can begin to understand Jacob's reasoning behind his actions when he met up with Esau in our study. He was attempting to give back the blessing he had taken from Esau 20 years prior. Not the birthright blessing, which was rightfully his, but the blessing which he had deceitfully stolen. The herds and the flocks he set apart for Esau represented wealth, the dew of heaven, and the richness of the earth. The sevenfold bowing, calling Esau my Adonai and himself your servant, represented the handover of power. Be master over your brethren and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Jacob understood that the sustenance of the Almighty was sufficient and wanted to make things right with his brother Esau. He expresses his newly found truth in these words to his brother in Genesis 33:11. "Please take my blessing that is brought to you, because Elohim has dealt graciously with me. and because I have all. So he urged him, and he took it. Jacob understands that he is complete in all he has. He wants Esau to take not only the gift of his animals, but the blessing that was never meant for him. In order to have it all, he must give it away. These are the truths that Jacob learned in the wrestling match. The wrestling match was the birth of Israel. Jacob learned that his wealth and power came not from the earth, but from the one who transcends this earth. Jacob struggled and prevailed to gain this truth. And in the same way, we also must strive to be overcomers. Like Jacob, we must learn that no matter what the odds are, no matter how much it hurts, we cannot let go of the man that has so much power in our lives. Yeshua overcame the world, and through faith, we can follow in his footsteps. John 16:33 says, "These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." 1 John 5:4, "For anyone born of Adonai overcomes the world, and this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith." There's even a special position promised to those who overcome. Remember what I was talking about earlier? Revelation 3:12 says, "He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my Adonai. To him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne." We all long to see his face. In fact, the last chapter of the Bible gives us a picture of eternity when we will see the face of the Almighty and his name will be written on our foreheads, Revelation 22:4. "They shall see his face, and his name shall be on their foreheads." If you have any insights, please call in 619-789-6815. 619-789-6815. I'm going to go ahead and put that in the chat room. If there's anybody out there listening, I would love to hear what you have to say regarding what we've talked about so far, what we've heard. Let's go ahead in the meantime and move on to Genesis chapter 34.
Genesis 34. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the women of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he seized her, and lay with her, and humiliated her. And his soul was drawn to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman, and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying,
"Get me this girl for my wife."
Now Jacob heard that he had defiled his daughter Dinah, but his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob held his peace until they came. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. The sons of Jacob had come in from the field as soon as they heard of it, and the men were indignant and very angry, because he had done an outrageous thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing must not be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying,
"The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him to be his wife. Make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us, and take our daughters for yourselves. You shall dwell with us, and the land shall be open to you. Dwell and trade in it, and get property in it."
Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers,
"Let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me, I will give. Ask me for as great a bride price and gift as you will, and I will give whatever you say to me. Only give me the young woman to be my wife."
The sons of Jacob answered Shechem and his father Hamor deceitfully, because he had defiled their sister Dinah. They said to them,
"We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we agree with you, that you will become as we are by every male among you being circumcised."
"Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to ourselves, and we will dwell with you and become one people." But if you will not listen to us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter, and we will be gone."
Their words pleased Hamor and Hamor's son Shechem. And the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. Now he was the most honored of all his father's house. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city and spoke to the men of their city, saying,
"These men are at peace with us. Let them dwell in the land and trade in it, for behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters as wives, and let us give them our daughters."
"Only on this condition will the men agree to dwell with us to become one people, when every male among us is circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock, their property, and all their beasts be ours? Only let us agree with them, and they will dwell with us."
And all who went out of the gate of his city listened to Hamor and his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. On the third day, when they were sore, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and came against the city while it felt secure and killed all the males. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the sword and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went away. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds, their donkeys, and whatever was in the city and in the field, all their wealth, all their little ones and their wives, all that was in the houses, they captured and plundered. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi,
"You have brought trouble on me by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household."
But they said,
"Should he treat our sister like a prostitute?"
Genesis 35. God said to Jacob,
"Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there. Make an altar there to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau."
So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him,
"Put away the foreign gods that are among you, and purify yourselves, and change your garments. Then let us arise and go up to Bethel, so that I may make there an altar to the God who answers me in the day of my distress, and has been with me wherever I have gone."
So they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods that they had and the rings that were in their ears. Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree that was near Shechem. And as they journeyed, a terror from God fell upon the cities that were around them, so that they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. And Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. And there he built an altar, and called the place El Bethel, because there God had revealed himself to him when he fled from his brother. And Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried under an oak below Bethel. So he called its name Allon-Bacuth. God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Paddan-Aram and blessed him. And God said to him,
"Your name is Jacob. No longer shall your name be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name."
So he called his name Israel, and God said to him,
"I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come from your own body. The land that I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give to you, and I will give the land to your offspring after you."
Then God went up from him in the place where he had spoken with him. And Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he had spoken with him, a pillar of stone. He poured out a drink offering on it and poured oil on it. So Jacob called the name of the place where God had spoken with him Bethel. Then they journeyed from Bethel. When they were still some distance from Ephrath, Rachel went into labor, and she had hard labor. And when her labor was at its hardest, the midwife said to her,
"Do not fear, for you have another son."
And as her soul was departing, for she was dying, she called his name Ben-Oni, but his father called him Benjamin. So Rachel died, and she was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is, Bethlehem. And Jacob set up a pillar over her tomb. It is the pillar of Rachel's tomb, which is there to this day. Israel journeyed on, and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder. While Israel lived in that land, Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. And Israel heard of it. Now the sons of Jacob were 12, the sons of Leah, Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah, Rachel's servant, Dan and Naphtali. The sons of Zilpah, Leah's servant, Gad and Asher. These were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Paddan Aram. And Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre, or Kiriath Arba, that is, Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years, and Isaac breathed his last, and he died and was gathered to his people, old and full of days. And his sons Esau and Jacob buried him.
Okay, I did Genesis 34 and 35. Sorry for the long pregnant pause in between the two. I was trying to get back to the studio and make that happen quicker because the commentary just kind of goes into both of those. And if you have any commentary, please give me a call, 619-789-6815. So far I've been doing all the talking here. This is not been much of a house church. It's been Rob talking. So I'd love to hear what you think on some of this. It's very interesting in the last part there where it says that Isaac was at Mamre. And in my book, I just finished book two, by the way, Archon Invasion, The Rise, Fall, and Return of the Nephilim. Just finished it yesterday and sent it off to the printer today for a proof. So hopefully that'll come out well and we'll be that'll be up for sale. In my BabylonRisingBooks.com site. But I spent a lot of time talking about the various giants and Nephilim in the land and made mention of Mamre and also Arba quite a bit in the text. And we see here that Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre. It's a place Mamre was an Amorite, as well as Arba. The city of Hebron was once known as Kiriath Arba or the city of Arba, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. So apparently Isaac died somewhere in that area. The days of Isaac were 180 years, so he lived a pretty good life, 180 years. And he breathed his last. I find it interesting that both Jacob and Esau are there to bury him, so they were still reconciled, at least at this point. Looking at the commentary that we've been reading so far, he makes mention of, I'll read the paragraph I read earlier about the mixture here. It says, the fact is that, let's see if I can say that again, Mahalath was quite a mixture. It is true that she had no Canaanite blood in her, but with Hagar as her grandmother, she turned out to be three-quarters Egyptian. So when we put this all together, we see that Esau was intermingled with Hebrews, Hittites, Hivites, Ishmaelites, and Egyptians. Now, this information sheds new light on the incident that happened at Shechem. Without going into great detail, we know that Hivite men of Shechem were slain in a surprise attack by Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi. The wealth of the city was seized, and the women and children carried away captive. Jacob was much disturbed over this, fearing all the surrounding Canaanite nations would unite to attack him with overwhelming odds. In Genesis 34:30, we see Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land. They will gather themselves against me and kill me. I shall be destroyed, my household and I." And who do you suppose had the potential of gathering all of these inhabitants for an attack? I, this being the person named Adele, from this website would suggest that it was Esau who had made all the connections through his marriages. Jehovah, however, restrained such an attack, and Jacob continued to live under the protection of the Almighty. This is a pretty cool scripture that I've overlooked in the past, but it's probably pregnant with meaning. Genesis 35:5, it says, "And they sojourned, and the terror of Elohim was upon the cities that were all around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob." Now, in the translation that we were looking at, that's a different translation right there, but the translation we just heard is from the English Standard Version. It says, "And as they journeyed, a terror from God fell upon the cities that were around them, so that they did not pursue the sons of Jacob." I don't know what that was, but it had to be pretty something pretty significant, especially when you consider a lot of these guys were Nephilim, probably giants. Pretty cool. Okay, let's continue. There was a very disturbing incident in our study this week concerning Jacob's daughter Dinah. I'm going to pass on to you many of the insights of Rav Aman Bazak from his commentary on this study. Rav Bazak makes a comparison between the episode at Shechem and the city commanded to be destroyed in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 13, beginning in verse 12, it says, "If you hear someone in one of your cities, which Jehovah your Elohim gives you to dwell in, saying, 'Corrupt men have gone out from among you and enticed the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which you have not known,' then you shall inquire, search out, and ask diligently. And if it is indeed true and certain that such an abomination was committed among you, you shall surely strike the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it, all that is in it, and its livestock with the edge of the sword." And I point out in my book that where you see God saying utterly destroy, and especially when he's talking about utterly destroying everything, including women and children, those were Nephilim cities. "And you shall gather all its plunder into the middle of the street and completely burn with fire the city and all its plunder for Jehovah your Elohim. It shall be a heap forever. It shall not be built again. So none of the accursed things shall remain in your hand, that Jehovah may turn from the fierceness of his anger and show you mercy, have compassion on you, and multiply you just as he swore to your fathers. Because you have listened to the voice of Jehovah your Elohim to keep all his commandments, which I commanded you today, to do what is right in the eyes of Jehovah your Elohim." Now let's list the parallels between the two cities. Both concern someone who set out to convince the people of their city. Genesis 34:20 says, "And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came to the gate of their city and spoke with the men of their city, saying," compare that with Deuteronomy 13:13, "Corrupt men have gone out from among you and enticed the inhabitants of their city, saying." Both describe a serious act that takes place in the city. Genesis 34:7 says, "And the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved and very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing that ought not be done." Compare that with Deuteronomy 13:14, which says, "Then you shall inquire, search it out, and ask diligently, and if it is indeed true and certain that such an abomination has been committed among you." In both cases, the people of the city are put to death by the sword for their abominations. We see in Genesis 34:25, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city and killed all its males. And they killed Hamor and Shechem, his son, with the edge of the sword. Compare that with Deuteronomy 13:15. "And you shall surely strike the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it, all that is in it and its livestock with the edge of the sword." Rav Bazak points out one obvious difference between the stories concerning the spoils. First, let's take a look at the conclusion of the brothers' mission to save Dinah. Genesis 34:25 says, "Now it came to pass on the third day, when they were in pain, that two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city and killed all the males. And they killed Hamor and Shechem, his son, with the edge of the sword, and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went out." The mission is completed, right? Dinah has been rescued and taken home. Yet there is more to the story. Jacob's sons returned to the city and helped themselves to the plunder. Genesis 34, beginning in verse 27. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city, because their sister had been defiled. They took their sheep, their oxen, their donkeys, what was in the city and what was in the field, and all their wealth. All their little ones and their wives they took captive, and they plundered even all that was in the houses. Now read and contrast that with what happens with a condemned city in Deuteronomy, and note the warning in Deuronomy 13:15, beginning in 15. You shall surely strike the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it, all that is in it, and its livestock with the edge of the sword. And you shall gather all its plunder into the middle of the street, and completely burn with fire the city and all its plunder, for Jehovah your Elohim. It shall be a heap forever. It shall not be built again. So none of the accursed things shall remain in your hand, that Jehovah may turn from the fierceness of his anger and show you mercy, have compassion on you, and multiply you just as he swore to your fathers. Putting to death all the inhabitants of the city was a very difficult mission. It has been observed that this sort of an act dulls the senses of a person's moral sensibilities. Hence the reason for Jehovah's promise in the Torah, that he will turn from the fierceness of his anger and show mercy and have compassion on the hearts of those who were asked to carry out this destruction. He will wipe away the moral damage caused by their acts of killing. The heart is the key here. The destruction in Deuteronomy is to be performed purely as an act of obedience to Jehovah your Elohim, according to Deuteronomy 13:16. There is to be no personal gain in the mission. So now we are able to see the act of Jacob's sons in a new light. And if in Jehovah's eyes the killing of the residents of Shechem was justified, the plundering of the city was certainly not justified. Now it would be seen as outright murder done out of anger, along with satisfying their own personal interests. There is no promise of mercy for those who killed out of anger and greed. This also helps us to understand the rebuke given to the brothers at the end of Jacob's life. In Genesis 49:5, beginning in verse 5, we see Simeon and Levi are brothers. Instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling place. Let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united with their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. Still, we are left with the question as to why Jacob remained silent when he initially found out about Dinah's disgrace. And his response to his son seems self-centered. Genesis 34, beginning in verse 30, then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me. I shall be destroyed, my household and I. Jacob encounters one trial after another. He had only recently prevailed in his wrestling match with the reward of receiving a new name. The following morning, he had a successful meeting with his brother Esau. That experience must have put him in the peace mode. Why was he facing another trial? What lesson had he not yet learned? Jacob is now fearful of the inhabitants of the land and that they might gather against him and kill him. Perhaps what he still had to recognize was the primary threat to him and his family, that of assimilation into the land of the inhabitants of Canaan. We sometimes call it the mixing of the seed. The Torah would strictly forbid Israel's daughters to play the whore, lest the entire people be polluted. Perhaps Simeon and Levi understood this danger. However, they wrongly operated out of anger. We see in Leviticus 19:29, do not prostitute your daughter to cause her to be a harlot, lest the land be full of harlotry and the land become full of wickedness. At Deuteronomy 22, beginning in verse 21, then they shall bring out the young women to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her to death with stones, because she has done a disgraceful thing in Israel, to play the harlot in her father's house. So you shall put away the evil from among you. I would like to end with a look at the controversial covenantal birthright blessings from Abraham to Jacob. Abraham was promised that he would become the father of Goy, that is, a nation. Genesis 12:2. I will make you a great nation, Goy. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. Later he is told that he will become the father of many nations, Goyim. The covenant is also declared to be everlasting. We see in Genesis 17:5, or beginning in verse 5, no longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be called Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations, Goyim. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you, and your descendants after you, in their generations, for an everlasting covenant, to be Elohim to you and your descendants after you. The blessing is passed down to Isaac. In his blessing, we also see the promises of the seed, the Messiah, through whom all the nations of the earth would be blessed. Genesis 26:4. And I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations, the Goyim of the earth, shall be blessed. Initially, Jacob receives the covenantal blessing from his father Isaac when he left for Haran. Genesis 28:3 says, may El Shaddai bless you and make you faithful or fruitful and multiply you, that you may be an assembly of peoples. Jacob is told he will multiply and become a Kahal Amin. Kahal is commonly translated as congregation. Jacob is promised that he will become a congregation of peoples, a homogeneous group united in purpose as opposed to a variety of nations. Elohim makes an appearance to bless Jacob when he returns to the land. It says in Genesis 35:11. Also, Elohim said to him, I am El Shaddai, be fruitful and multiply. A nation and an assembly of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. Let's summarize the birthright, covenantal blessings concerning descendants. Abraham, a great generation, Genesis 12:2, father of many nations, Genesis 17:5. Isaac, promise of the seed points to the Messiah to bless all the nations, Genesis 26:4. Jacob, an assembly of peoples, Genesis 28:3. A nation and an assembly of nations, Genesis 35:11. By the way, assembly, that's where we would get the word church from. It helps you to understand why Stephen said the church in the wilderness, the church is Israel. It's not some new identity in addition to Israel. The church is Israel, and that's throughout the Old Testament. It's just people interpreting the New Testament to get it all messed up. Now, concerning Jacob, what I want you to see is that this Kahal is sometimes linked with the nations and sometimes linked with the peoples. And Kahal designates an organized religious body and has come together with that has come together with purpose. Usually Kahal is translated as ekklesia in the Greek Septuagint. See, ekklesia. Then in the Brit Hakadesha, I'm sorry, with my Hebrew is not that good, ekklesia is generally translated as church. I hope that helps you to better understand the prophecy given to Jacob. We could maybe expand on it a bit and say the prophecy included a nation and a church of peoples from the nations. That is the definition of the identity of Jacob, also known as Israel. It has all been a process for Jacob. Only after pursuing his heart of sin in the form of deceit, pride, idolatry, and selfishness was he able to experience intimacy with the Holy One of Israel at Bethel, house of El. The different aspects of his personality will be lived out through his sons. They will all indeed struggle with their own personal ascent to meet with the Almighty. But no matter what, the nation of Israel will live on. Its story is beset with trials and tribulations, but ultimately prophecy indicates restoration. And our Torah study tells us of a generation or congregation of peoples, Kahal, Amin, from the nations, Goyim, who will also seek out their identity as Israel. The struggle is part of the process. But we can learn from these stories and perhaps lessen the pain. Remember, Jacob was promised truth, Micah 7:20, and the truth led him to his identity as Israel. And Ardell concludes with, "Our precious Heavenly Father, open our eyes that we may see wondrous things from your Torah," Psalm 119, 18. And he concludes with Shabbat Shalom. But there is still another chapter in this study that we haven't covered yet, and that's chapter 36. If you have any insights you'd like to share, please call in 619-789-6815. 619-789-6815. In the meantime, here is Genesis 36.
Genesis 36.
These are the generations of Esau, that is, Edom. Esau took his wives from the Canaanites: Ada, the daughter of Elon the Hittite; Aholibamah, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon the Hivite; and Basemath, Ishmael's daughter, the sister of Nebaioth. And Ada bore to Esau Eliphaz. Basemath bore Reuel. And Aholibamah bore Jeush, Jalam, and Korah. These are the sons of Esau who were born to him in the land of Canaan.
Then Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the members of his household, his livestock, all his beasts, and all his property that he had acquired in the land of Canaan. He went into a land away from his brother Jacob, for their possessions were too great for them to dwell together. The land of their sojournings could not support them because of their livestock. So Esau settled in the hill country of Seir. Esau is Edom.
These are the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites in the hill country of Seir. These are the names of Esau's sons: Eliphaz, the son of Ada, the wife of Esau; Reuel, the son of Basemath, the wife of Esau. The sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz. Timnah was a concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son. She bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These are the sons of Ada, Esau's wife. These are the sons of Reuel: Nahath, Zerah, Shammah, and Mizah. These are the sons of Basemath, Esau's wife. These are the sons of Aholibamah, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon, Esau's wife. She bore to Esau Jeush, Jalam, and Korah. These are the chiefs of the sons of Esau: the sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn of Esau, the chiefs Teman, Omar, Zepho, Kenaz, Korah, Gatam, and Amalek. These are the chiefs of Eliphaz in the land of Edom. These are the sons of Ada. These are the sons of Reuel, Esau's son, the chiefs Nahath, Zerah, Shammah, and Mizah. These are the chiefs of Reuel in the land of Edom. These are the sons of Basemath, Esau's wife. These are the sons of Aholibamah, Esau's wife, the chiefs Jeush, Jalam, and Korah. These are the chiefs born of Aholibamah, the daughter of Anah, Esau's wife. These are the sons of Esau, that is, Edom, and these are their chiefs. These are the sons of Seir the Horite, the inhabitants of the land: Lotan, Shobal, Zibeon, Anah, Dishan, Ezer, and Dishan. These are the chiefs of the Horites, the sons of Seir in the land of Edom. The sons of Lotan were Hori and Hemam. And Lotan's sister was Timnah. These are the sons of Shobal: Alvan, Manahath, Ebal, Shepho, and Onam. These are the sons of Zibeon: Aya and Anah. He is the Anah who found the hot springs in the wilderness as he pastured the donkeys of Zibeon, his father. These are the children of Anah: Dishan and Aholibamah, the daughter of Anah. These are the sons of Dishan: Hemdan, Eshban, Ithran, and Kiran. These are the sons of Ezer: Bilhan, Zaavan, and Achan. These are the sons of Dishan: Uz and Aran. These are the chiefs of the Horites, the chiefs Lotan, Shobal, Zibeon, Anah, Dishan, Ezer, and Dishan. These are the chiefs of the Horites, chief by chief, in the land of Seir. These are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the Israelites. Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom, the name of his city being Dinhabah. Bela died, and Jobab, the son of Zerah of Bozrah, reigned in his place. Jobab died, and Husham of the land of the Temanites reigned in his place. Husham died, and Hadad, the son of Bedad, who defeated Midian in the country of Moab, reigned in his place, the name of his city being Abith. Hadad died, and Samla of Masrekah reigned in his place. Samla died, and Shaul of Rehoboth on the Euphrates reigned in his place. Shaul died, and Baal-Hanan, the son of Achbor, reigned in his place. Baal-Hanan, the son of Achbor, died, and Hadar reigned in his place, the name of his city being Pau. His wife's name was Mehetabel, the daughter of Matred, daughter of Mezahab. These are the names of the chiefs of Esau, according to their clans and their dwelling places, by their names. The chiefs Timnah, Alva, Jetheth, Aholibamah, Elah, Pinon, Kenaz, Teman, Mibzar, Magdiel, and Iram. These are the chiefs of Edom, that is, Esau, the father of Edom, according to their dwelling places in the land of their possession.
All right, there's a whole bunch of names there, and I didn't have time to look them all up. I apologize, but I have learned a long time ago that what's in a name? An awful lot. I can't stress it highly enough. I need to put a link in the extras for this study. There's actually a website. I forget the address, but I'll look it up. Oh, wait a minute. I can put it in the chat room here. Yeah, it's BibleCenter.org, and it's spelled Bible, B-I-B-L-E. Center is spelled C-E-N-T-R-E. Instead of E-R-T-R-E, .org. And that's the online version of the book that I've referred to a number of times, The Dictionary of Scripture Proper Names. It's a great resource that really helps to bring the scriptures alive, especially when you come to all those, I just posted the link in the chat room, when it comes to all those weird names that you can't pronounce, we tend to just skip over because we can't pronounce them. Let me just suggest to you that there's an awful lot of information contained in those names. And we saw who Esau was mixed with. He was mixed with Nephilim clans. And when you look up some of these names, like, well, the Horites are interesting. They are known as troglodytes or cave dwellers. Some have suggested that they were the giants that built Petra and other places like that, these cities in the rock. Seir means goat-like. Could that be a satyr, maybe? Man, I'm just telling you, if you start looking in these names, some of them are pretty wild. Not all of them, but a fair amount of them are pretty telling. I probably need to do an addition to my book because I forgot to mention these being the offspring of Esau. Something I did find interesting, though, and I put it in the extras for this particular study, and I'll post that link in the chat room as well. You can check this out. Is something from the book of Jasher. And right now, the only two things that I have in the extras section is the commentary that I was reading from that website, younglivingwaters.com. You see the link there to the PDF that I was reading from, so you can check that out for yourself. But also this section from the book of Jasher, chapter 61, one of the descendants of Esau was this guy named Zephel. And there's an interesting story about him in Jasher 61, beginning in verse 14, going through 17. It says, "And it was one day that Zephel lost a young heifer, and he went to seek it, and he heard it lowing round about the mountain. And Zephel went, and he saw, and behold, there was a large cave at the bottom of the mountain. And there was a great stone there at the entrance of the cave. And Zephel split the stone, and he came into the cave, and he looked, and behold, a large animal was devouring the ox. From the middle upward, it resembled a man. From the middle downward, it resembled an animal. And Zephel rose up against the animal and slew it with his swords. And the inhabitants of Chittim heard of this thing, and they rejoiced exceedingly. And they said, What shall we do unto this man who has slain this animal that devoured our cattle? And they all assembled to consecrate one day in the year to him, and they called the name thereof Zepho after his name, and they brought unto him drink offerings year after year on that day, and they brought unto him gifts. Now, I'm telling you, your Bible is full of cool stuff, but you just got to know where to look for it, and so much of it can be found in the Hebrew. Those of you out there think the only Bible in the world worth looking at is the King James Bible. I respect your opinion, but I respectfully disagree. You need to look at multiple translations to see what's really going on, but get into the Hebrew, man, because there's just a lot of cool stuff in there, like in the meaning of the names. I try to bring a fair amount of that out in my book, Archon Invasion, and the Rise, Fall, and Return of the Nephilim. I'll see if I can pull some of it up for you here. I don't know how quickly I can get to it. Maybe I'll look it up during the Haftorah portion, the reading of the prophets. If you've got any insights that you'd like to share, please call me, 619-789-6815. This is the first virtual house church where I've been talking to myself for 2 hours or an hour and a half so far. So I'd love to hear what you have to say if you've got any insights. Something else I forgot to mention before we go to the Haftorah portion was where Jacob sets up a stone pillar to mark the place where God had spoken to him again, and that's in Genesis 35:14, and he anoints it with oil. And again, this is the second time he's done that. He has an encounter with God, sets up a rock, and he anoints it with first time with wine and oil, and this time it says that he anointed it with just with oil. Let's see. Even a pillar, and he poured oil upon it. Yeah, it looks like he just poured oil, and it doesn't look like he poured wine on it also. But when you realize that Yeshua is the rock, he refers to himself as the rock, I have to wonder if that's not what's being spoken about here. These two rocks that he set up that Jacob, or Israel, anoints with oil, and Yeshua is the anointed one. Now, you ever wonder why he's anointed? Why do they say he's the anointed one? Who anointed him? Well, as I'm looking at this, it appears to me that it's Israel that had anointed him a couple times with oil as the rock. And hang on just a second here. My phone is blinking like it's about to die out on me, and that would be bad. So hang on just a second here. There we go. Sorry about that. Oh, the joys of live broadcasting. Anyway, just something to think about. Could be. And maybe that's related to Revelation chapter 6, verse 6, when he's talking about the third horse of the apocalypse, and he says, touch not the oil or the wine. Could it be saying, touch not the anointed ones? Touch not Israel? Touch not the church? Could be. All right, let's go ahead and play the portion from the prophets, which is Hosea chapter 11, verses 7, or beginning of verse 7 going through 12:12. But I actually liked what verses 1 through 6 had to say, so I'm just going to go ahead and play all of Hosea 11 and chapter 12 up to verse 12, because it's interesting. We actually covered Hosea 12 in last week's portion. So it's kind of the verses before last week's session. We did Hosea 12:12 through 14:10. And this is Hosea 11 through 12:12. So it's interesting that the sages and the people who put together these portions thousands of years ago make this connection. But anyway, enough rambling for me. Let's go ahead and listen to Max McClellan read the King James Version of Hosea 11 and 12.
Hosea 11. When Israel was a child, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. As they called them, so they went from them. They sacrificed unto Balaam, and burned incense to graven images. I taught Ephraim also to go, taking them by their arms, but they knew not that I healed them. I drew them with cords of a man, with bands of love, and I was to them as they that take off the yoke on their jaws, and I laid meat unto them. He shall not return into the land of Egypt, but the Assyrian shall be his king, because they refuse to return. And the sword shall abide on his cities, and shall consume his branches, and devour them because of their own counsels. And my people are bent to backsliding from me. Though they called them to the Most High, none at all would exalt him. How shall I give thee up, Ephraim? How shall I deliver thee, Israel? How shall I make thee as Admah? How shall I set thee as Zeboim? Mine heart is turned within me, my repentings are kindled together. I will not execute the fierceness of mine anger. I will not return to destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not man, the Holy One in the midst of thee, and I will not enter into the city. They shall walk after the Lord. He shall roar like a lion. When he shall roar, then the children shall tremble from the west. They shall tremble as a bird out of Egypt, and as a dove out of the land of Assyria. And I will place them in their houses, saith the Lord. Ephraim compasseth me about with lies, and the house of Israel with deceit. But Judah yet ruleth with God, and is faithful with the saints. Hosea 12. Ephraim feedeth on wind, and followeth after the east wind. He daily increaseth lies and desolation, and they do make a covenant with the Assyrians, and oil is carried into Egypt. The Lord hath also a controversy with Judah, and will punish Jacob according to his ways, according to his doings will he recompense him. He took his brother by the heel in the womb, and by his strength he had power with God. Yea, he had power over the angel and prevailed. He wept and made supplication unto him. He found him in Bethel, and there he spake with us. Even the Lord God of hosts, the Lord, is his memorial. Therefore turn thou to thy God, keep mercy and judgment, and wait on thy God continually. He is a merchant, the balances of deceit are in his hand. He loveth to oppress. And Ephraim said, Yet I am become rich, I have found me out substance. In all my labors they shall find none iniquity in me that was sin. And I, that am the Lord thy God from the land of Egypt, will yet make thee to dwell in tabernacles as in the days of the solemn feast. I have also spoken by the prophets, and I have multiplied visions, and used similitudes by the ministry of the prophets. Is there iniquity in Gilead? Surely they are vanity. They sacrifice bullocks in Gilgal. Yea, their altars are as heaps in the furrows of the field. And Jacob fled into the country of Syria, and Israel served for a wife, and for a wife he kept sheep.
All right, that's the Haftorah portion, or the reading from the prophets that ties into what we just looked at from the Torah portion, in this case being Genesis 32 through 36. Something to consider is where he's talking about Ephraim, he's talking about us. Unless you are blood related to any of the other tribes of Israel, you are adopted into this family under the banner of Ephraim. That's what's talked about in next week's Haftorah portion, which is Ezekiel 37, the two sticks coming together. Ephraim, the stick of Ephraim that has his associates, Ephraim and his associates, and the other stick is Judah and his associates. That's the two coming together being one. That's us. And when you look at this, something that jumped out at me as I was looking at this section here, is how God, through the prophet Hosea, keeps mentioning the land of Assyria, which is Babylon, Iraq, and that whole region, that whole area over there, and Egypt. And I got to keep coming back to this. Babylon is rising, and it's not a metaphor. It's not New York City. It's not the Vatican. It's not all these allegorical things people like to make it out to. A lot of people who teach eschatology, they try to make pretty much everything except Iraq the Babylon of the Book of Revelation that rises. And I just simply maintain that the whole Bible bounces around what I call the Jehovah Triangle. The Jehovah Triangle is Israel, Egypt, and Babylon, Iraq. Well, you see it bouncing back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And you see it mentioned numerous times here in the Hosea passage that there's a bunch of association taking place specifically with Ephraim and the house of Israel as it pertains to the Assyrians, which we know, of course, Ephraim was part of the 10 tribes that were taken away by the Assyrians from the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom was later taken away by the Babylonians. But we're talking about the same general area. We're talking about the same people, and we're talking about the Assyrian. And what I see in the book of Isaiah, this is the proof of what I'm talking about regarding the Jehovah Triangle, as I call it. It's in Isaiah 19, verses 23 through 25. It says, "In that day, Egypt and Assyria will be connected by a highway. The Egyptians and the Assyrians will move freely between their lands and will worship the same God." That hasn't happened yet. "And Israel," and that's capital G, by the way, "and Israel will be their ally." That hasn't happened. "The three will be together, and Israel will be a blessing to them. For Jehovah Almighty will say, 'Blessed be Egypt, my people, blessed be Assyria, the land I have made, and blessed be Israel, my special possession.'" God's whole plan centers around these three nations and what takes place in between the Jehovah Triangle. And we see an awful lot here dealing with Ephraim. So I don't have all the answers. I'm new to this myself. And like I tell people all the time, look, don't believe anything I say. Don't listen to me. I'm a student. I'm trying to figure this stuff out myself. And that's why I really wanted to have a lot of people to chat with, because I like to hear other people's insights and learn from what they have to say as well. This is the first virtual house church we've had so far where nobody's called in, so I'm not quite sure what's going on today. Maybe I didn't promote it well enough or something. Anyway, love to hear somebody else's insights on this regarding what you're seeing in the Haftorah portion here in Hosea. He says in Hosea 12, "And I that am Jehovah thy God from the land of Egypt will yet make thee to dwell in tabernacles as in the days of the solemn feast." And that looks to me like the Feast of Tabernacles being spoken of there. And he's talking to Ephraim. So could it be saying that the greater exodus that is coming up, that we would call the Great Tribulation, is going to involve us, Ephraim, being out in the wilderness somewhere, dwelling in tents or some kind of tabernacles, as in the days of the solemn feast? We'd be talking about the Feast of Tabernacles. It would be a Sukkot. The reason we're supposed to mikra these moedim, which means rehearse these appointed times, is because there's going to come a time when we're going to have to know how to pick up, pack up, and go and make dwelling places for ourselves. And it could be that in the last days we may see a repeat of this, and that looks like what is being said here. I'm not sure. I'm just kind of looking at it and trying to figure it out myself, but that's what it looked like. That's what it looks like to me. If you have any insights, give me a call at 619-789-6815. That's it for the Torah portions and the portion from the prophets. And we've actually got time now to go ahead and take a look at the New Testament readings, which are 1 Corinthians 5, 1 through 13, Hebrews 11, 1 through 40, and Revelation 7, 1 through 12. So I'm going to go ahead and read those. I didn't put those in the pre-recorded queue, so you will have to listen to me some more. Let me see. I'm going to pick a different translation so I don't trip up all over the these and thous and all that stuff. I'm going to read from the New Living Translation. 1 Corinthians 5, 1 through 13. And if you're listening to this in the archive, anytime you see these other readings, whether they be from the prophets or from the New Testament, there's a reason that they're done on this day, and it's because they directly relate in some way to the Torah portion reading that precedes them. And it basically shows you how the Torah is woven through the whole Bible. So as you consider these other passages from the prophets and from the New Testament, be thinking, how does this relate to the Torah portion, which we just heard from Genesis? Because they're related somehow. So 1 Corinthians 5, 1 through 13 says, Paul condemns spiritual pride. He says, "I can hardly believe the report about the sexual immorality going on among you, something that even pagans don't do. I am told that a man in your church is living in sin with his stepmother. You are so proud of yourselves, but you should be mourning in sorrow and shame, and you should remove this man from your fellowship. Even though I am not with you in person, I am with you in the spirit. And as though I were there, I have already passed judgment on this man in the name of the Lord Jesus. You must call a meeting of the church. I will be present with you in spirit, so you will, and so will the power of our Lord Jesus. Then you must throw this man out and hand him over to Satan so that his sinful nature will be destroyed and he himself will be saved on the day the Lord returns. Your boasting about this is terrible. Don't you realize that this sin is like a little yeast that spreads through the whole batch of dough? Get rid of the old yeast by removing this wicked person from among you. Then you will be like a fresh batch of dough made without yeast, which is what you really are. Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed for us. So let us celebrate the festival, not with the old bread of wickedness and evil, but with the new bread of sincere truth. Now, for those of you who think that the church is not supposed to practice the feasts, they're not the feast of the Jews, first of all, they're the feast of Yehovah. This is an example right here where Paul, the one that everybody likes to use to say that Jesus did away with the law and the feast, is telling Christians in Corinth about the feast of unleavened bread. That's what he's talking about here in verses 6 through 8. He says, let us celebrate the festival, which is the feast of unleavened bread, not with old bread of wickedness and evil, but with the new bread of sincerity and truth. During that particular feast, they get rid of all the leaven in their house, so they eat only unleavened bread, hence the name, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So Paul is saying, let us celebrate the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Yes, we are supposed to still be doing the feast. And it's not a have-to, guys, it's a get-to. Once you understand the purpose and meaning behind these feasts, man, you are going to get real excited, as opposed to the totally, completely meaningless and totally pagan-based holidays that we celebrate in the church today, i.e. Christmas and Easter, which have nothing to do with Jesus. You can't put Christ in Christmas because he was never there to begin with, at least not in terms of what the holiday represents. Of course, he's in every day, 365 days of the year, but December 25th was Mithra Nimrod's birthday, not Jesus' birthday. Has nothing to do with him. And once you realize that, yeah, I know, guys, these holidays mean a lot to us. They have a lot of fond memories for us. I'll be the first to admit that I have great memories surrounding both Christmas and Easter. I used to write and direct plays on Christmas and Easter, and even play Jesus in passion plays and whatnot. I get it. When I walk in the stores today and all the Christmas music is playing, man, there's that little thing inside me that wants to go in that direction again, that yearns for the nostalgia of it. Laying on the floor, looking up through the leaves of the Christmas tree and seeing the lights dancing on the ceiling and smelling the smell of the freshly cut tree. Man, I love all that stuff. I get it. But once I understood the true meaning, and don't believe me, go look it up for yourself. Watch the videos that I posted in the extra section from the previous study, Truth and Tradition, in particular by Jim Staley. There's another one called Sunburned by 119 Ministries that they just put out on this. It's well worth it to check it out. If you want to be obedient and do it, God says, learn not the way of the heathen. Don't worship me the way the heathen do. There's many places in the Bible where he says, do not do what the heathen do and slap my name on it. Associate me with these other things. He says it in many places. And that's exactly what we're doing with Christmas and Easter. We may say that we are thinking about him with our hearts, but it doesn't matter what we think. It matters what he thinks. Anyway, I'm going to get off my soapbox on that. But once you trade in the two pagan holidays for the seven feasts of Yehovah, which are his holidays, and the Sabbath makes eight, you're trading two for eight, guys. It's a good deal. And you understand the significance of these feasts, man, you're just going to get, I'm telling you, everybody wants to call me a Judaizer, but I'm telling you, I'm just trying to do Bible things in Bible ways, and it is cool. It's exciting. You learn so much about who God is and who Yeshua is and what our salvation is all about by doing Bible things in Bible ways and learning his way and not the pagan ways. And you'll see all through the New Testament that both Yeshua and the apostles kept the Sabbath, and they kept that, the Sabbath being Saturday. They didn't change it, and they observed the feast. And I believe we're still in Hanukkah right now. So if you really do want to celebrate December 25th for some, as some having some significance, man, Hanukkah is it. I know it shifts on the calendar, because the Hebrew calendar is different than the Gregorian calendar. So last year, I think it was actually on December 25th. Also, this year, I think it'll end before December 25th. But the original Hanukkah, man, what a cool story. You need to look into it. The story of the Maccabees, it's in the Apocrypha. Actually, I heard Mel Gibson is thinking about doing a movie about the Maccabees. I hope he does, and I hope he does it justice, too, because he certainly could do it well, because it is another Braveheart kind of thing. And you realize that Antiochus Epiphanes had set up a statue of Zeus in the temple and offered up a pig, which is a prototype of the abomination of desolation, desecrating the temple, on December 25th. And then 3 years later, on December 25th, the Maccabees and the Maccabean revolt took back the temple, tore down the statue of Zeus, and rededicated. That's what the word Hanukkah means, dedication, rededication. They rededicated the temple of Jehovah back to God by getting rid of paganism. If you wanted to celebrate something on December 25th, stop practicing paganism with God's name on it and celebrate, man, the rededication of your life and the church and the temple and everything. Your body is now the temple, rededicated back to Jehovah by getting rid of the pagan stuff. That's what December 20th, and it was known in the New Testament times, I guess it probably still is today, as the Feast of Lights, or the Festival of Lights. And Yeshua himself attended the Festival of Lights, and that's when he made this statement. He said, hey, I am the light of the world. Cool stuff, man. So anyway, I just get fired up about this. That's kind of cool. So we see that Paul here in 1 Corinthians is talking about celebrating the Feast of Unleavened Bread. When I wrote to you before, I told you not to associate with people who indulge in sexual sin. But I wasn't talking about unbelievers who indulge in sexual sin or are greedy or cheat people or worship idols. You should have to leave this world to avoid people like that. Or you would have to leave this world to avoid people like that. I meant that you are not to associate with anyone who claims to be a believer yet indulges in sexual sin or is greedy or worships idols or is abusive or is a drunkard or cheats people. Don't even eat with such people. It isn't my responsibility to judge outsiders, but it certainly is your responsibility to judge those inside the church who are sinning. God will judge those on the outside. But as the scriptures say, you must remove the evil person from among you. There's your tie-in right there. This is some of the things we read. So people say, don't judge me, regarding these things. Look, I'm not judging anybody, first of all. I'm just trying to state some things here that I've been learning from the scriptures that God says don't have things to do with the heathen. That's like Paul saying, look, the world's going to do what they do. Pagans are going to do what they do. But when it comes to being the people of God, we are to judge within ourselves those who are sinning. And those pastors out there that want to preach against the law, man, Matthew says, Jesus said in the book of Matthew, those who teach against it will be least in the kingdom. Maybe you want to be, whatever least in the kingdom looks like, but I'm not so sure you want to be teaching against the law, because you're basically saying, go ahead and sin, guys. Sexual sin, go for it. Because sin in the Bible is defined as lawlessness. Lawlessness means not having the law. Now, this has nothing to do with your salvation, guys. So you want to post something for people to, say, Rob's talking about legalism here, getting under the law. That's not what I'm talking about. We are saved by grace through faith in Christ alone. It is not of works, lest any man should boast. I get it. Once you purchase your righteousness, which comes through Christ and Christ alone, who fulfilled the law perfectly, we should obey the law for one reason, out of love and obedience. Does not a child display their love for their parents by being obedient? How much love do you feel from your kid if they're being disobedient versus being obedient? So we are children of God, our Heavenly Father, who paid the price for our sin, which is violation of the law. Should we not then be thankful, grateful, and then show our love for him to him by trying to be obedient? And when we're not, when we're sinning, Paul says you're supposed to judge those within that are sinning. Specifically in this case, he's talking about sexual sin. And that, he lays it out, what we're supposed to do with that. Hebrews 11, 1 through 40 says, faith is the confidence that what we hope for will actually happen. It gives us assurance about things we cannot see. Through their faith, the people in days of old earned a good reputation. By faith, we understand that the entire universe was formed at God's command, that what we now see did not come from anything that we can see. It was by faith that Abel brought a more acceptable offering to God than Cain did. Abel's offering gave evidence that he was a righteous man, and God showed his approval of his gifts. Although Abel is long dead, he still speaks to us by his example of faith. It was by faith that Enoch was taken up to heaven without dying. He disappeared because God took him. For before he was taken up, he was known as a person who blessed God or pleased God. And it is impossible to please God without faith. Anyone who wants to come to him must believe that God exists and that he rewards those who sincerely seek him. It was by faith that Noah built a large boat to save his family from the flood. He obeyed God, who warned him about things that had never happened before. By his faith, Noah condemned the rest of the world, and he received the righteousness that comes by faith. And it was by faith that Abraham obeyed when God called him to leave home and go to another land that God would give him as his inheritance. He went without knowing where he was going. And even when he reached the land God promised him, he lived there by faith, for he was like a foreigner living in tents. And so did Isaac and Jacob, who inherited the same promise. Abraham was confidently looking forward to a city with eternal foundations, a city designed and built by God. It was by faith that even Sarah was able to have a child, though she was barren and was too old. She believed that God would keep his promise. And so a whole nation came from this one man who was as good as dead, a nation with so many people that, like the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore, there is no way to count them. All these people died still believing what God had promised them. They did not receive what was promised, but they saw it all from a distance and welcomed it. They agreed that they were foreigners and nomads here on earth. Obviously, people who say such things are looking forward to a country they can call their own. If they had longed for the country they came from, they could have gone back. But they were looking for a better place, a heavenly homeland. That is why God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. It was by faith that Abraham offered Isaac as a sacrifice when God was testing him. Abraham, who had received God's promises, was ready to sacrifice his only son Isaac, even though God had told him, "Isaac is the son through whom your descendants will be counted." Abraham reasoned that if Isaac died, God was able to bring him back to life again. And in a sense, Abraham did receive his son back from the dead. It was by faith that Isaac promised blessings for the future of his sons, Jacob and Esau. It was by faith that Jacob, when he was old and dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and bowed in worship as he leaned on his staff. It was by faith that Joseph, when he was about to die, said confidently that the people of Israel would leave Egypt. He even commanded them to take his bones with them when they left. It was by faith that Moses' parents hid him for 3 months when he was born. They saw that God had given them an unusual child, and they were not afraid to disobey the king's commands. It was by faith that Moses, when he grew up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to share the oppression of God's people instead of enjoying the fleeting pleasures of sin. He thought it was better to suffer for the sake of Christ than to own the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking ahead to his great reward. It was by faith that Moses left the land of Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He kept right on going because he kept his eyes on the one who is invisible. It was only by faith that Moses commanded the people of Israel to keep the Passover and to sprinkle blood on the doorposts so that the angel of death would not kill their firstborn sons. It was by faith that the people of Israel went right through the Red Sea as though they were on dry ground. But when the Egyptians tried to follow, they were all drowned. It was by faith that the people of Israel marched around Jericho for 7 days, and the walls came crashing down. It was by faith that Rahab the prostitute was not destroyed with the people in her city who refused to obey God, for she had given a friendly welcome to the spies. How much more do I need to say? It would take too long to recount the stories of the faith of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and all the prophets. By faith, these people overthrew kingdoms, ruled with justice, and received what God had promised them. They shut the mouths of lions, quenched the flames of fire, and escaped death by the edge of the sword. Their weakness was turned to strength. They became strong in battle and put whole armies to flight. Women received their loved ones back from the dead. But others were tortured, refusing to turn from God in order to be set free. They placed their hope in a better life after the resurrection. Some were jeered at, and their backs were cut open with whips. Others were chained in prisons. Some died by stoning. Some were sawed in half, and others were killed with the sword. Some went about wearing skins of sheep and goats, destitute and oppressed and mistreated. They were too good for this world, wandering over deserts and mountains, hiding in caves and holes in the ground. All these people earned a good reputation because of their faith, yet none of them received all that God had promised. For God had something better in mind for us, so that they would not reach perfection without us. And finally, our portion from Revelation chapter 7, verses 1 through 12. Then I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds, so they did not blow on the earth or the sea, or even on any tree. And I saw another angel coming up from the east, carrying the seal of the living God. And he shouted to those four angels who had been given power to harm land and sea, "Wait, don't harm the land or the sea or the trees until we have placed the seal of God on the foreheads of his servants." And I'll suggest to you that the Sabbath is a seal, if not the seal, of God. And we find that in the Torah. Sabbath is a sign, it is a seal between God and his people. And I heard how many were marked with the seal of God. 144,000 were sealed from all the tribes of Israel. From Judah, 12,000. From Reuben, 12,000. From Gad, 12,000. From Asher, 12,000. From Naphtali, 12,000. From Manasseh, 12,000. From Simeon, 12,000. From Levi, 12,000. From Issachar, 12,000. From Zebulun, 12,000. From Joseph, 12,000. From Benjamin, 12,000. Contained within Joseph is Ephraim, by the way. And we would say that that's probably associated with Manasseh, who is mentioned above. Praise from the great crowd. After this, I saw a vast crowd, too great to count, from every nation and tribe and people and language, standing in front of the throne and before the Lamb. They were clothed in white robes and held palm branches in their hands, and they were shouting with a great roar, "Salvation comes from our God who sits on the throne and from the Lamb." And all the angels were standing around the throne and around the elders and the four living beings. And they fell before the throne with their faces to the ground and worshiped God. They sang, "Amen, blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and strength belong to our God forever and ever. Amen." And that's all we have for this particular study. I'm sorry nobody joined me to share their insight. But as you are listening to those New Testament passages, consider, what do they have in common with Genesis 32 through 36? All right, that's all the time we have for tonight. So we will see you back. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. I'd like to do one more before next week, maybe even two, so that we can do the actual Torah portion for December 21st. sunset Friday night to sunset Saturday night is the Shabbat, and next Friday is December 21st, 2012, the end of the Mayan calendar, potentially the end of an age, and the beginning of another one. What's going to happen that day? I have no idea. There are a lot of interesting signs pointing to that day, but I'm most interested in the signs that Yehovah put in place for us, specifically the reading for that week. So we've got a few to do between now and then. Perhaps if I can convince Kevin, we'll see. Maybe he'll join me tomorrow, Sunday the 15th. Tomorrow is Saturday. We'll be doing a study at his house. So Sunday the 16th, perhaps, we can do the Torah portion week 9, and perhaps the Torah portion week 10 I'll do maybe some other time during the weekday so that we can do Torah portion 11 on the day, the actual day, December 21st, 2012. We'll see. Check back. Check the show notes at blogtalkradio.com/revolutionaryradio and check my Facebook, facebook.com/Rob Skiba, and we'll see what we can do to try to get caught up in this next week. Now that I have book 2 off my plate, what a relief. I've got a bit more time, although I am still preparing some PowerPoint presentations, but that's not nearly as time-consuming as editing a book. So hopefully I'll have time to do a few shows this week. So check in and see. All right, good night, everybody. We'll see you back whenever I'm able to get back on the air. Take care.
Have you ever wondered why some banks offer promotional savings rates that come crashing down after a few months? You deserve better. And when you bank with Capital One, that's exactly what you'll get. With a Capital One savings account, you'll get one of the nation's best rates that's not a promotional rate. Plus, you can open an account online in just 5 minutes. Welcome to Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet?
For consumers only. Offered by Capital One NA, member FDIC. Copyright 2017 Capital One.
Cricket Wireless, take one. Can you try Friendly?
Get 4 lines of unlimited data for $100 a month.
Try Tougher.
Get 4 lines of unlimited data for $100 a month.
Try Sexy.
Get 4 lines of unlimited data for $100 a month.
British Sexy.
Get 4 lines of unlimited data for $100 a month.
Wow, you've got amazing range.
Smile. You're on Cricket.
With Cricket Unlimited plan only required on all 4 lines. Discount per line varies. Data speed limited to max 3 megabits per second. Video streaming at SD quality. After 22 gigabytes per line per month, you may experience slower speeds. Fees, usage, and restrictions apply. See store for details.